I'm Ann Peterson. For those of you who haven't been here, for those of you that have, this is my final session on where in the world is God. I don't know if we've become any clearer about that, but at least we've raised more discussion and had more ideas. When I'm not here, I teach at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. My primary interests and background in theology are in Luther, process theology, Alfred North Whitehead, science and religion, and feminist theology. And those are the areas I've taught and worked in. And that's what really has played into the discussion of where in the world is God. Each session has a musical title, and some of this, again, a summary. I've mentioned that the very first class that we had, I don't know if any of you were there, but we had a little phrase that I used by Alfred North Whitehead, who said, it's better that a proposition be interesting than that it be true. It's better that a proposition be interesting than that it be true. And I use that for my theological method because I figure that the purpose of theology, particularly for the church, should be one that's evocative. That is to create discussion, to create interest, and to be fruitful, and much less to be about right or wrong. I think the questions where we deadlock over, is this the correct theological interpretation, belongs, if you want to do that, you can go to graduate school and argue about it. But I think in the long haul, what produces interesting and rigorous theology is its fruitfulness. Does it lead one to a different life? Does it expand, enlargen one's beliefs? And so I think Whitehead was on to something when he said that the whole purpose of theology should be to make it interesting and worry less about its truth in the sense of right or wrong. So that truth is inherent in its interest. In other words, it's very pragmatic. Does it work? Does it lead you somewhere? Does it make sense? One of my favorite descriptions of truth from one of the theologians I've read, Marjorie Suhaki, said that truth is like trying a garment on off the clothing rack. You want to see how it fits. So that truth is in part fit. And that's really the kinds of method that I use in teaching theology. Susan Brill dubbed me 2 days ago a wanton eclectic, which I found out later was a term that she had been called herself. That is, those who collect things from all over and try to make sense out of putting them together. And I do that, I think, in part because I have a large interdisciplinary interest. I have a music background. My undergrad was in music. So the themes for this, variations on a theme, where in the world is God, each of these has had a musical theme. The theme for today is motive. Some of you may or may not recognize that. If you've played Bach, you recognize that word. When I was at Concordia College, during my first year of piano, I had a teacher who every about 4 to 6 weeks we'd have piano class. And the first thing that every one of his students played was a Bach invention. We'd either have a 2 or 3 part invention. And we broke down the piece into little tiny pieces. And some of the, I don't even know if I can remember this anymore, but you may recognize this. Right? That little, I think it's number 8 in F major. That little da 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 bump, that's the motive. And then Bach takes that and twists it and turns it, and you hear it 9 million times in your left hand and in your right hand. And the interesting thing for me was, of course, playing Bach inventions are not easy. It takes a lot of practice. And so I learned to play those little motifs or motives in about 8 million varieties of patterns. Backwards, upside down in other keys in different rhythmic patterns, inside out to the metronome at one speed, metronome another speed, and I began to realize that there's what I call the art of practicing the particular. That is paying very careful attention to the details. And I think that's paid off. I mentioned this last week in a session that when med schools look for really good candidates for medical school, the people that they want are music majors. It's one of the most highly valued majors for getting into med school. They still want you to have all a science background. But because music majors have spent so much time attention to detail and consistent practice. I know at Concordia we were assigned a practice room 4 hours a day, so I spent most of my days for the first 2 years at Concordia practicing 3-4 hours a day, often doing nothing but going over and over little tiny details, and that has really paid off in my life. I still have wonderful habits of being able to sit for long periods of time and know how to use that discipline. So I know when I teach at Augustana, my two favorite kinds of students to get are musicians and athletes, because they know how to be disciplined. They know what it is to be consistent. They know what it is to have to pay attention to detail. So today, the purpose of this session, after all that introduction, is to how we're going to pay attention to the particulars in our life. How do we practice the particulars? So that the question of where in the world is God, we've looked at it in all different kinds of ways, from postmodernism or questions of diversity, questions of science and technology, questions of landscape or geography. Yesterday we talked about it in terms of evil, and today we're going to talk about it, I think, in more practical, everyday, where do you find God in your life kinds of questions. And I want to start with a thought question in just a minute, but what I want to go back to is the theological category of incarnation, God in the flesh of the person of Jesus Christ, and how that Christian view of God in the world challenges or reshapes, I think, two worldviews that many of us have inherited about where God is in or not in the world. One is classical theism. That is the view that we've inherited from many of the church, early church thinkers, from Augustine, Anselm, Aquinas, Boethius. The notion that God is above and over against the world, and one model for that is God as king, the world as kingdom. The way you talk about God is everything that the world is not. God is all-powerful, all-good, all-knowing, and we're just the opposite, okay? And the direction of causality is always one-directional. God influences the world, but the world really doesn't ultimately influence God. Anselm uses the attributes or characteristics of God as impassibility and mutability. God can't feel. God is unable to change. And of course, you can understand why that fits a certain religious piety, because you want God, it says, to be that which you're not, right? But I think other thinkers come along, in particular Luther and others, and challenge that view of God as being radically transcendent, radically other than the world, because if the incarnation makes a difference in the world, it also makes a difference about who God is. It's not just that God changes Jesus, but I'd even want to propose that Jesus changes God's self in some sort of way. Not that God wasn't imminent and present in the world before, but that it makes a difference to who God is. The other picture that it challenges is a more recent picture. That is what a lot of Americans have grown with, is the notion of God as deistic. That is the absent landlord. The God who sort of got the clock going, put the parts together, wound the universe up, and now it runs on its own. And the language that goes with that kind of picture is of intervention, God intervening in the world. And again, I think the notion of incarnation or God in Jesus Christ radically challenges that picture of God. So that we really, in a way, kind of want to rule out the language of intervention and this notion of complete or radical otherness in which God is sort of incapable of responding to or reacting to what the world has to offer. So I think the incarnation challenges those two worldviews. This is just sort of broad sweeping review. Any questions about that? It's pretty clear.
I see that G for God and W for world. Uh-huh. I don't know why you don't make it an 8. God is within the world.
What I'm saying is that in classical theism, you wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Okay.
What I would say is, yes, absolutely, you're right, is in the picture we're going to draw, it's going to be more like that, where they're mutually influenced and where God is much more involved intimately in the world. And it's not that classic, it's not that Anselm and Aquinas and these people, I don't want to just broadly say they didn't think God was somehow in the world. But there was a much stronger emphasis on radical transcendence and otherness. And when you read Anselm, God is unable to feel. I mean, there's these attributes of impassibility, omnipotence meant ability to control all things. And of course, starting with Luther and other thinkers in the tradition, that has been radically challenged because of the notion of incarnation. It's not that God isn't all powerful, but we might understand power in a different way. That is, God's power as empowering, as being with, instead of lording it over. Okay? Yeah.
Are you going to speak a little more about intervention and why that was challenged?
Mm-hmm. But sure. I think the language of intervention, and I hear it just a lot from students, and I fall in that myself sometimes, but the language of intervention implies that God, especially in the picture of deism, the world is out there somewhere, and God's kind of the absent landlord. Mm-hmm. And periodically, intervention means to step in and step out. If you do a family intervention and there's a problem with alcoholism in your family, the family that would normally be kind of out of that person's life steps into the crisis, tries to solve it, and then steps out. Well, I think that's problematic from the notion that it implies, for one thing, it raises big questions about why does God intervene in some situations and not others. And it also raises the question of this notion of absenteeism, as if God's sort of watching things and then says, well, they're not getting it too well down there, and sort of steps in. So that's, and I also think it's not very biblical. At least it may be in some sense, but most of the time, Dan, you might want to help me out with this, but a lot of language of Scripture has God in a much more active relationship in which God is intimately involved. Yeah.
Wasn't the response of most deists to the intervention business that we should simply wait and see? You know, it's like now we see in a mirror dark. Mm-hmm. The fabric is being woven. We don't know. Right. Pope's Essay on Man, mm-hmm. when he deals with the Odyssey, he says, you know, we struggle and question, you know, fit in. Fit into the chain of being.
Yeah.
Don't try to be an angel. Don't try to be God. Just wait and see, and you will know the purpose of all things.
That's
and
helpful.
You hear a lot of that theology around.
Yep.
Especially when there's no intervention. Mm-hmm. You know, a family is desperate for God's hand, mm-hmm. let's say. The hand of God is a frequently used word.
Right.
Do you see God's hand in this?
Mm-hmm.
And if God doesn't intervene, and that caused me my first major crisis in faith, when God did not intervene and my brother died.
Yeah.
And it took me 10 years to pull out of that and form a new kind of mm-hmm. concept of God's.
That's helpful.
Don't you think that the language of intervention is most common and that stance most wanted in the language of prayer, or, mm-hmm. or the language in which you are supposed to ask for God's intervention,
sure. right?
Or, and so then what you replace it with, and when people want you to pray for them,
mm-hmm.
it is with that in mind,
yeah.
rather than that you'd be able to tolerate the pain or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
I think there's a way of talking about God, and maybe you know we'll get to this, and this kind of leads us to this last question. I think it's more helpful to talk about God as being always active, always present. And of course, there are ways to distinguish that, and we'll want to talk about what those differences might be. But, you know, it's the relationship of the parent in some way. You know, there are certain kinds of parenting. I'm not one. Maybe those of you who are can help, where I see parents who seem to act at a distance, and they'll step in the moment of crisis. But there's also the parenting, and I, you know, I'll point up there since I know this family, right? I'll make an example, but I know the Rodies, and I've watched them parent, and it's a wonderful give and take relationship where it's not sort of stepping out and only intervening when there's a crisis. You know, it's not like at Walmart when everybody's crazy and then the parents finally step in and try to correct everything. But It's somehow this wonderful give and take, and it's not that there aren't problems, or I'm sure everything is always perfect. but I've watched this sense of give and take, and somehow prayer for me seems more that, mm-hmm. that it's a give and take relationship. And for me, prayer is finally the word I used yesterday, an enigma. I think we still don't always think through what the result of prayer is, and that's a wonderful example of what do we do with this whole issue. How do we understand God involved in our prayers? And of course, there are all different kinds of prayers. There's intercessory prayers for people to be healed. And I listened carefully last night. We got, those of us who were leaving Holden today stood up to receive a blessing. And the prayer for us was, you asked for everything in life, but what you got was life. You asked for it. So that the notion that what you wanted, you didn't get, but in fact, you got everything. So I think the concept of prayer really is important to work this out. There's a wonderful little new book out by Marjorie Suhaki. I'll put her name up here. It's a Chalice Press publication called In God's Presence. And it's just a simple, wonderful little reflection on prayer. And she wrestles with these exact kind of questions. Languages of intervention, language of classical theism, and then tries to offer what she called a more relational model between God and the world.
Pam?
Yeah.
It may also be helpful to say that it isn't that God doesn't intervene, mm-hmm. but that God doesn't only intervene.
Right.
Intervention is certainly one of God's options. Mm-hmm. But what ends up happening is whenever we talk about something, we leave some other things out.
Right.
And probably that could go the reverse, that mm-hmm. when you talk about the give and take, then we're leaving out this sort of radical, dramatic
yeah.
sort of movement, which we believe happened in Jesus, mm-hmm. for example. An intervention talk is, I think, helpful to talk about
yeah.
God's movement in Jesus, because as a parent, there are certainly moments you have to intervene.
Right. Right.
But if that is the exclusive definition of the relationship, then it gets real weird.
And I think that might be a real helpful clarification, because if Inga's, as a small child, is going to put her hand on the hot stove, you don't want to sit back and say, well, you know, she'll learn better if she squirts her hand. You're going to pull her off. You know, the question that we're never going to solve in this, that we dealt with yesterday, is why are there people squirting their hands and God doesn't pull them out? I mean, we're not going to answer that. So that remains part of the troublesome side of faith and this whole question. Yeah, Jan? Yeah.
I hesitate to recommend this book because it's not specifically Christian mm-hmm. and it's not specifically about prayer.
Mm-hmm.
But it helped me, I think, more than any other book during a long period of illness. And I ordered it for the bookstore when I was working there because mm-hmm. I want other people to read it. But I don't know how they're going to do so unless I recommend it.
What is it?
It's by an oncologist. And it's his name is Stephen Levine, L-E-V-I-N-E. It's called Healing into Life and Death. Mm-hmm. And his basic premise is one you've probably heard of before, but I think he puts it better than anyone else I know. And he provides guided imagery for meditations, which for me are like prayers.
Mm-hmm.
And the premise is this, that we have had a spate of books about healing, which suggests if your attitude is right, okay, so a Christian could say, if you just pray hard enough, God is going to heal you.
Mm-hmm.
So what he does is to play with our notion of healing.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes out on the side of healing as a possibility, whether you live or you die, which is the most healthy attitude to have when one is ill. I mean, the point is not really to be cured in a medical sense,
mm-hmm.
but to have your soul prepared for death. And we all should be in that business, whether we consider ourselves very healthy or not. So I recommend it to anyone, whether you are facing an illness or I'd say it's particularly helpful for perhaps you or relatives have cancer, but it helped me and I didn't have cancer, so.
Well, it's a wonderful image of restoration, mm-hmm. fulfillment, and looking at life in a broader, I think that sounds wonderful. Well, some of the very best books to learn about theology are not necessarily theological.
Well, he draws on Christian uh-huh. and Buddhist and, Jewish.
Yeah.
It's fairly epileptic as far as the religious background is concerned.
Well, thank you. Yes?
Well, this is a very elementary question, but when you think about, maybe it's too much of a generalization, but the average person calls upon God only when there's a crisis.
Right, sure.
Is this a responsibility of the church? Where did this all start? Did it start with this kind of a belief of intervention? In other words, I think that out of that, maybe people learn to just call, sure. Pray or ask mm-hmm. God for help on their deathbed or another type of crisis arose in their life.
I think that's an excellent insight, and I think it leads down to this question. How do you know when God is present and working in your life? And for many of us, it's easy to find those moments in crisis.
And then you set yourself up for disappointment or
exactly.
for becoming agnostic or whatever, mm-hmm. because you don't. If it doesn't do it, it's like she pointed out, it isn't the cure we want, it's the healing of the spirit.
Right, right. And
But that's what people are asking for.
Right. I absolutely agree with you. And I think to try to broaden this notion of God present in the world in particulars, then can help expand that so that we don't think of God just only at those moments of crisis.
How do we do that? How does the church do that?
Well, I think the church helps with that in a number of ways. One is, and I'm going to talk about this, I think the role of that Lutherans can help with that is to broaden and emphasize the notion of God in a sacramental way. And by that I don't just mean baptism and the Eucharist, which I think are what we call sort of the paradigmatic or the symbolic elements. Those are the places where we know God is present. But to broaden what sacramental might mean. And one tradition that I think that can help us with that. And sometimes I'm accused of being sort of a crypto-Catholic because I love reading good Catholic theology. And I think part of that is the Roman Catholics have a very wonderful sense of sacramental presence. And in other words, God present consistently in all of life. And of course, they celebrate that in seven sacraments. And I'm not saying that Lutherans should do that. But it's a notion of honoring moments where God is present. And seeing that in a very broad sort of way. I want to read just, I'll try not to bore you to death with quotes today, but I think this is a helpful little one. It's from a woman, Susan Roth, a Roman Catholic theologian, and she says, in the Catholic tradition, the sacramental principle affirms that all of created reality reveals God. So all of creation, and I think that's where we need to start with. And I spent a whole week last week trying to say that the role of Jesus and our understanding of Christ belongs first within creation. So that the picture we understand of God in the world, I sort of drew it this way, creation is the framework around which we understand who Jesus is. And the church has done that since its inception. We start with the first article of the creed. I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. Okay, so somehow we see God in our lives in a broader way than just in my life or than just in Jesus, but first we understand God in all of creation. And I think the Catholics call that the sacramental principle. Lutherans, I think, have had that notion right from the get-go, that we understand God's grace available in all of the created order. And she says, and because God has chosen to live with humanity in the flesh, all of human life is transformed. Sacraments in particular are those events in which God is communicated in the church. So sacraments are more specific examples of what she broadly calls the sacramental principle. And I found a couple of years ago, I just kind of came upon a little piece by mantle, I'm going to head down to this category. If anybody has time to order this, it's a wonderful little treatise by a man named Jean-Pierre de Cussade called The Sacrament of the Present Moment. Anybody familiar with that? I had never heard of this book. About four or five years ago, the first time I went abroad, I went alone over to Oxford and to London. And I was on my way to Oxford to visit a favorite theologian of mine, Arthur Peacock. He's a biochemist and Anglican priest. And he's written a lot. And somebody said, well, you should stop in and have coffee with Arthur Peacock. So I called this Oxford scholar who I'd never met and arranged to have coffee with him at his flat in Oxford. And we had never really officially met. And I sat down at his home with his wife, and we visited for about 4 hours. And after talking, he said, you know, have you read, and it sounds like every Anglican theologian has read this little book somewhere in the training of Anglican clergy. They read this little piece called Sacrament of the Present Moment. It's written by a 17th century Jesuit who was a spiritual director for a community of sisters. And that's why, in particular, Paul, I thought of you in your program and direction. And he addresses this question about where do you find God? How do you know that God is present in your life? How do you practice this in the daily life? That was part of the whole notion of this. And he also addressed this little treatise against what he called the quietists of his day, those who just sort of felt that they could be passive. This was an attempt to get people active in their faith life. And his writing, I think, is rather wonderful. Where do we find God in the world? And he answers that question, I think, to his community that he's writing. And he writes the following. You are seeking God, dear sister, and he is everywhere. Everything proclaims him to you. Everything reveals him to you. Everything brings him to you. He is by your side, over you, around you, and in you. Here is his dwelling place, and yet you still try to seek him. You can tell what's happening. It's like, where is God? Where is God? Well, he's saying, right here. And yet you still keep asking the question. So that's why when I read this book, it hit home. It's like, yeah, you're the one he's writing to. Ah, you are searching for God, the idea of God in his essential being, or the God of classical theism. What you want is some abstract notion of God in his essential being. You seek a perfect God, and yet God lies in everything that happens to you. Your suffering, your actions, your impulses are the mysteries under which God reveals himself to you. That sounds really Lutheran to me. God is under the opposites. We talked about that a couple days. Subcontraries. God works in hidden ways. Luther talked about God working in that which was the opposite of where we might find God to be. So that's another place. That's Jan, your stories have helped us with that. Oh, she pop out of here. Okay. Jan Bowman has had some wonderful stories this week to help clarify that at moments where she least expected to find God is where we find God. So then he says, but he will never disclose himself in the shape of an exalted image to which you so vainly cling. So that's really helpful language to me. You want to know where God is? Well, look around you. God is in you, above you, over you, through you, with you. You know, you're looking to the heavens, to some exalted, big, powerful image. And de Cussade says, that's the last place that you're going to find God. Look to the places where you least expect God. Yes.
We've tended to support that with our idea that God created the earth and that was a finished work. Mm-hmm. Physics now is telling us that everything's a happening. And for instance, a boson is a particle that lasts a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a second. Mm-hmm. So that we're made up of momentary bursts of energy. However, each burst of energy happens with purpose. So maybe what things are really made of it is meaning, or the word, or the creation story, and God said, and it was. Mm-hmm. Maybe that is an ongoing process of how things come into being, not a organism that continues from one beginning.
Sure.
And if that is so, then God is involved in the becoming of everything. Mm-hmm. And each of us are an expression of the word of God. Here and now. that God is saying the word that undergirds our existence. So what it's doing is shifting the idea that there is matter, and then added to that is meaning.
Right.
It is saying there is meaning,
right.
And what is added to that is slower particles that mm-hmm. become matter.
It's a notion in, too, of the language of continuing creation. The notion that creatio ex nihilo, or creation out of nothing, that it was a one-time event, but that God is continually active, present in all of life. He used the example out of John or Genesis of the Word, and then you can talk about the Word becoming flesh, and flesh as an activity and event in which we're all in the process of becoming. It's not as if we stopped somehow. So that's a lovely example of what I think it, you're putting into 20th century language, what de Caussade was putting in 17th century. Yeah, I think I just love his little language. What he leaves one more quote from him, and he says, "Well, how do you go about finding God then? What are you going to do?" So, in spiritual direction, and this sort of fits your notion. He says, "What was best a moment ago is no longer, because it is removed from the divine will, which is passed on to be changed to form the duty to the next." So the sacrament of the present moment for him is, I think you're absolutely right on, that the present moment is a continuation, it's a constant becoming. That God is active in each inception, each moment of life. Luther said, if God were to withdraw God's self, the world would collapse and cease to exist. This notion that somehow God's power, it's not that God sort of lords it over and then steps back from it, but that God is somehow richly involved in all of life. Tillich called it the ground of being. Any sort of language that you can find that helps one to understand this ongoingness of God. So de Caussade says, well, how do you discern where God is? And he says, it's a wonderful image from music. It is like a musician who combines long practice with a perfect understanding of music, who is so immersed in their art that everything they undertake connected with it will have a touch of this perfection. If their compositions were to be examined, it would turn out that they conform perfectly to the conventions and that they were most successful when working unhampered by them. So much so that connoisseurs would hail their impromptus as masterpieces. For conventions, if followed too closely, restrict talent. Okay? What he's saying is that you become so thoroughly immersed in practicing the particulars of the faith that you begin to discern that then you have this moments of what the long hours of practicing those Bach things I introduced at the beginning. That's exactly what he's saying. You practice the motive over and over again, and eventually somehow it starts to take over inside of you. I've mentioned this before, having spent 5 months with the Benedictines, they know how to practice the art of the particular. I stayed up at St. John's for 5 months on sabbatical, and I think they know what de Caussade was talking about. By having the Psalms daily practiced, said, thought, prayed, it becomes a part of you. And whether you're practicing in the Psalms or whether you, whatever it is, but you're finding ways to practice the particular, to pay attention to detail. And it doesn't mean that you do it like the Benedictines. That's just one way of doing it. But it means being open to and listening to know how in your life God is present. And it may not be big flashing moments. Yes?
There's a symbol here, Holden, that I think echoes that, and that is the dancing servant, which mm-hmm. one foot is planted, so that's your practice and motif, and then the other foot is free to dance.
That's
and
good.
If you try to not have that foundation, then
you fall off.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. We used the image last week of the blues or improv and jazz. In order to play good jazz solos, you have to be thoroughly grounded in the tradition of jazz. I mean, you have to practice lots. And jazz musicians practice, work, think, breathe, eat jazz. When you get up and you listen to the great sax solo and it sounds like they're just standing up there doing their own thing, they've got one foot in that tradition that they've been practicing and practicing. So I think De Quesada is just trying to open up this notion of saying, don't look for, you know, if you're looking for God in the perfect, singular, great moments, you're looking in the wrong place. It's in the everyday particularities of life.
Yeah, this might be a recent vacation too, but I think it's really worth noticing that to pay attention to the present is extremely difficult for people living in, for example, the U.S. culture. Mm-hmm. Almost everything in our culture focuses on the future,
yeah,
about being satisfied in the future or doing something that will get to another time that will be better.
Mm-hmm.
And often in European culture, there's a focus on the past.
Yeah.
And so, and of course, you know, we also have a lot of influence from the European culture. And so for us to learn to pay attention to the present is extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to go against almost every other kind of influence and other kind of momentum that surrounds us in order to be able to do that.
I think you're right. I'm really embarrassed to admit how many times up here my mind has thought, you know, when I get back.
Sure.
I've tried really hard not to do that, and I think Holden provides a sort of place to practice the sacrament of the present moment. For one thing, it strips away all the things. It's been so nice not to have to answer email and voicemail and all the kinds of things that keep one constantly looking toward the next deadline, the next moment, the next goal. I know in my whole educational process, Jim and Dan and some of us have been talking about that life is sort of one extended process of a deadline. You know, you get through this degree and then you go through that degree and then there are orals and then your dissertation and you finally think that's over, but then there's, and that's just true for anybody. It doesn't matter what profession, what sort of...
And our entire economic system.
Right.
Is based on that.
Exactly.
And that surrounds all.
So it really is a challenge. Yeah.
See, I'm not sure I agree with the economic system. I agree with you, Nancy, that I feel like I'm just constantly looking for the next event. Like next Tuesday, we go out for the Sri Lankan family reunion, and then a week later, Karen leaves to go home, and then 2 weeks later, I go back to Decorah, and then a week after that, school starts, and you start going. But when I think about our economy, it seems to me so much of our economy is geared to spend in the present moment. I mean, we don't save anything for the future anymore.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. It's constantly a focus on what I have now is not enough, and I must buy more,
sure. Okay.
And then I will be satisfied. But of course, then I'm not satisfied.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, well, that's good. Yeah, yes.
Oh, well, it seems like what she's talking about, it's almost paradoxical in that we live in a world of sound bites.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we do live in the present, but we don't stay in the present. I mean, we're not even allowed to stay there more than 5 seconds. And to stay in the present, I would agree, is a very difficult thing. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of concentration and focus to say, I want to enjoy this moment, this is important. But at the same time, the paradox, I think, is that we live in a world of sound bites, and at the same time, we have these short-term goals. They're always short-term. We don't look to the long-term or the future. The average person does it because we want immediate gratification. Mm-hmm. And that may not be this moment, may be tomorrow. We're not thinking about enjoying today, but we're thinking about what we may be doing or having tomorrow.
Yeah.
But I think that's a very product of this culture. And I think that's one thing that plays into this whole thing about feeling that God is always present.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you only want, he's present only at times, or it may sound like so.
Right. I think that's a great example. And it seems to me, De Quesada, that he's saying the same thing. I mean, our culture has different manifestations for it, but obviously this isn't... I think you're onto something, because he's saying, you know, this fits us. Yes?
I was just going to come back to your parenting example and application. I serve on the United Way Board in our community. There's a lot of concern about how parents are and what parents are doing, that kind of thing, and so... We listen sort of to one strategy after another for healthier parenting. And I'm taken at how to a number they propose taking people away from their kids. And it's like, you know, fundamentally, parenting is to be with your kids.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so here we've got a set of support groups or a group of classes, oh, this kind of consultation, that sort of thing. It strikes me that theology does the same thing in a way, that we're so willing to substitute an idea of God or a strategy of God, mm-hmm, for the God who is present in revealed incarnation.
Right. Yeah, Susan Brill had received the Disney World way of, yeah, some of us were talking about this, she received this brochure to go to Disney World to learn how to sort of make the church bigger. And part of it was, you know, using Disney techniques to do evangelism. And it's a little bit of that. It's sort of looking to everything else that sort of would take us away from maybe where God is in the present, particularly if God is present in the not so pleasant. You know, how do we sort that through? Yes?
Yeah, that's a community of joy. I went to a seminary with Mr. Kalstad. Mm. I don't just put it down because it's sponsored by AAL, which is my insurance company. and it's done nationally now, and it'll be in Washington State soon. I think it'd be curious to go to hear how Disney would create Jesus. I'm obviously a Looney Tune.
You are a Looney Tune.
But maybe Looney also. But the point is, I think the present moment, I use things like this because the bird, Tweety Bird, is wide-eyed. Mm-hmm. And I think why it's so difficult not to pay attention to the present, because we forget the predator is out there.
Yeah.
And when you forget that there is not a predator that preys on us, P-R-A-Y, I wish we knew that. But the other one we do know, once we know who's on our backside. And then all of a sudden, when Sylvester comes looking, and that seems to be the only purpose Sylvester has it, in cartoon anyway, to get that very large-headed, bright-eyed, intuitive, not very good speaking English, educated bird, then something happens in the present. And I think that's why it's so difficult when life is good, quote unquote, when I can pay my bills and go to my community reunions and do all my nice little things, and then all of a sudden cancer hits, or my daughter gets killed as our friends are up here, or my brother dies, and then the context is, why weren't you paying attention? I mean, the Columbine, I mean, everything that leads to that, you can't stop long enough to pay attention, not just to what God is doing,
right,
unless you want God to be Sylvester also, that's an option in the Bible, who's the predator, and what's the predator after with you? And so when the soul gets caught, and all the other images that we have, which are rich in the tradition.
Yeah. Thank you, that's helpful. Yeah.
Being present in the moment sounds like something we just do. Instead, it's the goal of the whole salvation story, and that is that the reason we can't stay in the present is because of anxiety. And so we try to solve it in the past. So the cross says you are forgiven. Anything that's happened in the past is forgiven, you can let go of it. And then the anxiety also says, well, you've got to make sure this future is safe. And the resurrection says the future is safe. Mm-hmm. So because of the cross and the resurrection, we can be present here and now.
Yeah.
And Jesus calls it, my peace I give to you.
That's helpful, I like that, thank you. We have about 15 minutes, I'm gonna just jump quickly to the next couple of points. Particularity can also be problematic. God is present in the particulars, but sometimes particulars are excluded. We could have a whole nother week-long session on the fact that God's universal grace comes to us in the particular life of the one we call Jesus. So how do we reconcile the particularity of Jesus amongst all the other particularities of Buddha, of Judaism, of Hinduism? I mean, how do we talk about God's universal scope of grace with what theology is uniquely called the scandal of particularity? So that's just one little piece you can think about. We're not going to even try to solve that one in this hour. But particularity can be problematic. Also, those particulars that have been left out. And another way to practice is to begin with the particulars that are excluded. And I keep reading Roman Catholic theologians, particularly women, for looking at how they've been excluded. And in particular, the sacraments, for many Roman Catholics, particularly women, have been painful. Because the one that, of course, that they're excluded from is ordination, of celebrating the sacraments. So how does one begin to rethink what Susan Ross talks about earlier, the sacramental principle, and in particular the sacraments of the church? She talks about thinking from those voices that have been excluded. So where do we see culturally, personally, around us, those voices that the church has systematically tried to exclude? And maybe theology needs to talk about those particular lives and try to find out ways to listen, to talk to them, to us, to begin. I think that changes a little bit how we think about particularity. If the maleness of Jesus has, I have a good Roman Catholic priest friend who said, if you take that to its radical form, those people who would be ordained would only be male Jews, right? Because if you take Jesus' maleness, you might as well take his Jewishness, and then, so you can see how that argument becomes problematic. But it's still strong. I know the new bishop in South Dakota Synod has just really clamped down on women's voices. And it's become much more rigid. People are getting nervous. I probably should be saying this on a tape, but that's all right. I'm not Roman Catholic. But it's happening not just in Roman Catholic traditions. Lest we think that's true, it's going all over. And lest we think that somehow Roman Catholics are the only ones that exclude people. Bless his heart, you know, I love Luther, but part of what happened in the Protestant sphere, of course, is that when women no longer needed to be part of the convent and left the monastic orders, the only alternative for women was the domestic sphere. So that as Christianity spreads through Protestantism, there's not the option anymore of becoming part of a monastic community where you could be trained, become literate, become educated. And for much of Protestantism, most of the particularities of the female were stripped out of the church. And you don't go in most Lutheran churches and have a statue of the Virgin Mary. We don't have the saints. We don't have the records of those wonderful voices that have been literally taken out of the tradition. So part of why I think we need each other is to listen about how we struggle with particularities. And issues of leadership, the whole question that keeps getting raised up here a lot, and it's, I think, obviously one in congregational life, is how we talk about ordination of gay and lesbian people. That's a particularity that the church still isn't facing in a way that listens to those voices carefully enough. So all I'm going to do at this point, because we're closing in on time, is to say, by beginning particularity with particularity, we might sort of turn around that question a bit about where God is in the world. Instead of just looking sort of abstract, again, theologically, we might start with the perspectives of those who've been excluded. And the resources of writings and perspectives are wonderful. So I'll just leave that at that point. But I think it does shift the question a bit. The last person I want to end with is Luther. Particular people, I wrote particular people, particular table. I always think of this in terms of how the Eucharistic table can be a place where we practice the art of discerning, loving, and caring for the particular people that we might not even particularly like. Luther always uses the language that God's grace is not just generic, it's always for us, pro nobis. And so I want to just use a couple of little quotes that I found from Luther. And I don't know, maybe sometime in my life I would have read these and they wouldn't have meant much. But in the last couple years, these have really meant a lot. Luther says, "So too, since Christ's humanity is at the right hand of God, and also in and above all things, according to the nature of the divine right hand, you will not eat or drink him like the cabbage and soup on your table unless he wills it. He also now exceeds any grass when you will not catch him by groping about, even though he is in your bread, unless he binds himself to you
and summons you to a particular table by his word. And he himself gives meaning to the bread for you by his word, bidding you to eat him. So it's a call that somehow in the practice of our sacramental life, we're called to a particular table with a particular community. And you sort of have to work that out. I think that's a challenge for those of us, and I'm just one of the guiltiest of this, of maybe not feeling comfortable in a particular setting and wanting out of that. One of the interesting things for us about having, in our married life, we lived in Minneapolis 5 years and Chicago 6 years, and we've lived now in Sioux Falls for 9 years, and part of our challenge of being there is a particular group of people who have said, staying here means being part of a community with us. And it's been really interesting to say that we could look even long range, 30, 40, I mean, we kind of joked about this group of friends known to Paul as the Hood, who might sort of retire, live together. And it isn't always easy. Sometimes people grate on each other's nerves and there are differences, but it's a way of living amongst each other in a committed sort of way. And your example earlier of our culture being on the move, not being willing to, many of us are so mobile in our life, even if we're not skipping communities, it's our daily life where we're constantly on the move. And so to have to come to Sunday morning Eucharist and know that you're eating with a particular people in your congregation at that table, and that's where you're going to find God. You know, right next to the parishioner, you may think this is the worst person, you just soon never, or you don't like the pastor particularly or whatever. That, those words of Luther really challenged me personally to say, well, that's where God is. Where do I want to know where God is? Right there, in the eating and the drinking with those people I don't even really like very well. Mm-hmm. And that's a place to try it out. So that maybe the next time you meet that person somewhere else, at Hy-Vee, at the grocery store or something, you might say, I learned something on Sunday morning. So I like Luther's example of that. And just to end with a little more quotes from Luther. Luther explains, God also now exceeds any grasp, and you will not catch him. He uses this phrase all the time. You will not catch God by groping about. Luther has that language. You're not going to get God by sort of, you know, groping out there somewhere. Even though he is in your bread, unless he binds himself to you and summons you to this particular table. So for Luther, he said, so when we eat Christ's flesh physically and spiritually, the food is so powerful that it transforms us into itself. I mean, again, Luther's not worried about the physics of that. But the whole Johannine image of God abiding in us, that food is so powerful that somehow God transforms something in you, something changes. And you may not know what that is. But that's the whole question of faith, isn't it? That you trust that somehow, even though you don't feel any different, that maybe you practice that art. And I'll just put in my word of hope that somehow Eucharistic fellowship can be practiced with some frequency. Because I think we're not very good at eating together. And those congregations who practice that may learn about eating together. Finally, he says, in short, who confines Christ to a particular place? Is it not the fanatics who locate Christ in heaven at a particular spot and force us to say, look, there he is? And what do they do when they direct the people to the gospel and to their neighbors? Are not neighbors and the gospel at particular places on earth? Is not Christ present in them? So where do you want to know where God is in the world? Luther says it's pretty clear. It's in the gospel, and it's in our neighbor. And of course, we can expand these neighbor to include what I think our Catholic friends do, to include all of creation. And so Luther kind of answers that question for me. Where is God in the world? At least for me now, at least I know this much, that God is present in the gospel, proclaimed in word and sacrament, and God is present in my neighbors.
even those I don't particularly like or want to know about. And neighbor taken in its broadest form. And of course, for Luther, the more he works on the notion of neighbor, it's the person in need. So I think somewhere back in our good old Lutheran tradition, I always find Luther richly aware of many of the same issues that we have, and a rich resource for counteracting some of the problems that we face. So where is God in the world? God is in the gospel. God is in the particular word, the particular table. We have about 2-3 minutes for comments or questions. This? I didn't want to have to say it's my own. I'm quoting Luther. Instead of hauling volumes of Luther around, I just haul my own book around. Yeah. So, but I can get the references for you. Yeah, Jim?
Well, I'm just thinking about yesterday's discussion about evil.
Mm-hmm.
And I have neighbors and we have enemies.
Right.
Sometimes our enemies live right next to us.
Yeah.
And that's the hard one, to see God in your enemies.
Right. I think it's the absolute hardest. I have to write an article in the next 3 months for a journal called Dialogue. We've been talking about this. It's a celebration or Festschrift for Paul Sponheim, who taught for many years. Some of you may have come through seminary through Paul. And we're supposed to write on God, power, and evil. And I'm going to raise that question that Jim did, which is, how do you talk about God's presence in the enemy? I think for me it's the most difficult question that we're facing right now. Because we're not going to come out of that with some ease, well, love your enemy. What if your enemy happened to rape and abuse and kill your neighbor's 4-year-old daughter? What do you do? I mean, what does it mean to talk about that? I think it's really difficult. And I don't think we can pretend to just be sort of easy about it. I think it's one of the most painful. My students, we've been doing sort of service or immersion projects in several of my classes, and one of the most powerful ones, and maybe I'll end with this, is an example of a group of students who decided to visit maximum security prisoners in, we had the state prison in Sioux Falls. And one girl in particular wanted to visit. She'd been sexually abused herself, and so her greatest fear, her greatest enemy, were men who were sexual abusers. And she decided that maybe she would try visiting somebody like that in prison. And it took unbelievable courage for the student to do that. And she came back and told the class her story of visiting with a man in his 40s, I believe, who looked a lot like her father. Now, that wasn't the father who had abused her, but... And had a life that sounded a bit like her father's. And as they began to talk, she was just overcome with finding out that this man sounded like somebody that she would know in ordinary life. And she actually developed some compassion for him. And I think it's not a kind of compassion that somehow excuses the behavior, but begins to understand that deep in her she might have that same capacity herself. And I remember the class was just sitting with their mouths open listening to this wonderful young woman tell the story about visiting, up at the pen, and having to be challenged by visiting the people that she thought she couldn't begin to talk with. Yes?
I think one of the powers of that movie, Dead Man Walking, is that it doesn't, it really holds in tension the power of the evil, and yet the, and repeatedly keeping saying, yeah, but it isn't that easy. It's a real effective movie for being aware that you can't just say, well, love your enemy.
Right, right, because you have to practice it, right? Yeah. That's the whole point of this thing.
And that there may be others hurting around, but it's really complicated.
Yeah, it's messy.
Yeah.
That's the other thing about particulars, is they're messy. Yeah. They're not clean, they're ambiguous, they're messy, they're dirty. I think I'm going to let you go. It's 10 o'clock and we are catching a boat down lake. I've enjoyed all of you. Thank you very much.